What if I told you you could be anywhere you want to be in just 3 years? It's true. By staying hyper-focused on your goals and purpose, you can make your vision a reality in just a few short years or even sooner. The trick is, you have to build the routine that will support you in getting there. The good news, we've already done the hard part for you. We created a free 5-minute morning routine tailored specifically to you. It's delivered straight to your inbox each morning, is designed to help you supercharge your mornings with clarity, focus, and inspiration. By committing to this 5-minute routine daily, you'll create total clarity on your purpose and goals, inspiration to help you build a lasting habit, and the life that you want in just 3 years. The best part, this tool is totally free. No strings attached, just valuable resources to help your inner and outer growth. So if you're looking for a short, easy morning routine that will help you, one, stay laser focused on your vision you have for your life, and two, help you make progress towards that vision every single day, head to adamhergenrother.com/future or visit the link in the show notes to create your future self today. Hey everybody, before we jump into our show today, I am super excited because this is the 100th episode of Business Meets Spirituality. So today we have a very, very special guest. We also have Hallie. But before we jump in the show, we have, you want to introduce yourself?
I'm Asher.
And how old are you, Asher?
7.
And Asher is my son, right? And he has a special message for everybody today about moderation, right? Mm-hmm. What does moderation mean to you?
Exercise and eating healthy.
Yeah, and you can have some treats in there, right? What's your favorite treat?
Warheads.
Warheads. Is it because you like the sour stuff? Yeah, awesome. So what do you do for exercise?
I go to my trainer.
Great. What does your trainer do?
He helps me exercise.
Yeah, and keep you focused. And he also talks to you about foods, right? What does he talk to you about foods?
That I have to try I have to try different foods every day.
Yes, exactly. What you do. Even if you don't like it, you still try it, right? Because right now you seem to be fixed on like one or two foods, oatmeal and syrup and chicken fingers. So we're trying to break that habit, right? Yeah, that's awesome. So what did you do at VASTA yesterday at your training?
I did test day.
Great. And what is test day?
Test day is a day where he tests what I can do.
That's awesome. And what did you test on?
I tested how many push-ups and sit-ups I could do in a minute. I did 24 sit-ups and 23 push-ups.
That's awesome. And what message would you love to give to our listeners as a thank you for being in almost 50 countries and having everybody listen to our podcast? What would you like to tell them?
Thank you for listening to Daddy's podcast.
Thank you. Hey everybody, I'm Adam Hergenrother. This is Business Meets Spirituality. We believe in personal growth through business success. Today I am joined by my chief of staff, Hallie. Hallie.
Good morning.
Whoa, see, did you just say good morning?
Yes, that was sarcastic.
I know it was sarcastic, exactly. But today we are super excited because this is our 100th episode. Some fun facts about that. We've been in almost 50% of all the countries that exist mm-hmm. currently. And I thought it was interesting that we are dominating the charts in Estonia. So I kind of bring that up as a 100th episode. Thank you, Estonia and UK. And I think we were on the US top charts as well too. So thank you to everybody for listening. To all of us, to Hallie and I kind of rambling, and we love your comments that you get back and forth, for how we kind of do this podcast. So we're excited to be here with you guys today.
Yeah. And that it's reaching,
yes,
and resonating,
yes,
with, people from all over the world. And in honor of that, perhaps we're going to travel,
yes,
a little bit on this episode.
That's a good way to lead into this.
Yeah.
I like that. So this is the 100th episode. And what we thought we'd do today is do an untold story of, I may have shared it a couple times.
Small, I was going to say, if you've been around for like 7 or 8 years, yes, you may have heard this story before.
But I traveled and hiked Kilimanjaro and then spent 7 days in Tanzania in the Serengeti at a place called Singida. And there was actually it was a big turning point in my life. And this happened in June of 2014. Mm-hmm. So we're 7 years on the anniversary, just about the anniversary of it. And there was four or five things that really stood out from hiking and spending time in Africa and in Tanzania, that I want to share with you guys today. So it's a fun story. It's kind of, it's interesting, but there's some really good kind of, lessons that we can learn from the story itself. Number one is actually how it started was I was actually at a, I was at a training event and I was having lunch with a friend of mine and a friend came up and sat down and he had just came back from hiking Kilimanjaro and he was telling us the story. So hopefully this ignites somebody else to go out and do something, whether it's hiking Kilimanjaro or just a local hike around your area, just get out, right? And it sounded so awesome. He was kind of explaining some of the things that he learned. So I was like, wow, that sounds like an amazing experience. So interestingly enough, my son is in the room while we're actually filming this and he was born like 3 or 4 months earlier before I went. So it was a big discussion because we had to plan it for a year. And my wife's like, you know, Asher's going to be like 4 months old. And she's like, but go, she's always supporting me. So it was really cool. And the way we actually timed this event was, we went over there with my buddy Nick and Aaron, and there was three of us and we wanted to go up and summit the day that there was a full moon. So we booked it like 8 months in advance, June, it was like mid-June, there was a full moon. So that way, because you're above the cloud line, because it's like 19,100 feet, just under 20,000 feet of vertical, which is a high level, by the way, if you've never been up that high. And so once you get about 15,000, you're typically above the cloud line. So you don't need headlamps. And at the last night, you actually summit starting at around 11 p.m. And we'll get into the whole story. But we wanted to make sure that we did it because we heard the best time to do this was to do it was full moon. So you just, it's like bright as can be at that level. So we booked it. And, you know, of course, we get over there. And, you know, jump in.
Sorry, I've got like a couple questions. So it was just a quick, like, I'm just going to go do this. Like, what really prompted you? You just wanted the experience. Why did you and Nick and Aaron decide to do it after that, hearing that one conversation?
Yeah, we heard it. And literally, I think that day, we just said, like, that sounds amazing. We want that experience. And I think this goes back to what we always talk about with live, learn, and play every day. And nobody knows when they're going to die, but you know you are. And so at the time, it was like, that sounds like an amazing experience. I love pushing myself physically. I love pushing myself mentally, which is more that actually ended up being more of a mental push than I did a physical push. And, you know, I wanted the experience of being able to do that. And they did too. And so instantly, I think within a week, we were signed up. Literally.
And then it was a year.
Yeah, it
later?
Was like eight. Yeah, it was, I think we signed up in like, I think we were there in August because I remember it being extremely hot when we were there at this training event. I think it was in August in Austin. So how hot it was. Yeah. So, and then it was the next year, it was basically just under a year. We had to book for it in order to make it happen that way.
And what did your training and preparation look like before you went?
Yeah, I mean, I did a lot of hiking, right? I mean, I live in Vermont, so I'm fortunate enough to be able to do that. But then also when I couldn't, I'd put a treadmill. Yes, thank you. And like a high level of incline. And you can just walk on that in case you can't because your calves are different things. And obviously we couldn't train at altitude in Vermont because the highest mountain we have is like 4,500 feet. So we couldn't really train there, but we trained a lot in the mountains. I would run up it. I would run down. And actually during that same time of year, I think I ended up doing a Spartan Beast that year. So I was already doing a lot of runs up and down the mountain. I think I would run up and down the mountain 2 or 3 times and kind of go up and over the mountain, then back over as kind of my training. So I had that kind of in my pocket coming into it.
Was it important for the strength or was it more about the endurance that you needed to train for?
I didn't really know. I thought actually going into it, I actually thought the hike was going to be harder. And for me, the hike was not hard at all. In fact, if altitude wasn't an issue, I'm pretty sure I could have been up and down the mountain in a day. If I had started early enough. In fact, people like Sherpas.
Well, especially now, because you're like pretty advanced and all that stuff.
But if Sherpas that are out there, they take a different route, but they run up Kilimanjaro and back in a day. There's actually a race that they do every year. And the thing is that they don't affect them because they're Sherpas and they have the ability to be able to withstand the altitude.
Well, they're acclimated to it.
Yeah, exactly. They're just acclimated because they do it every day. Right. And there's tons of Sherpas up there. I mean, we had Sherpas on our trip too as well, which had basically no water and just were carrying everything for us to make it easier. But anyways, they can go up it. So people go up and down that. I think they did it in like 16 hours. So I say a day, not like a 8 to 5.
Right.
It
like was a full 24 hours.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It was like a 16-hour day, I believe. Somebody ran that up their different route. So you could go up and back in 24 hours if you really, depending on where you started too. But anyway, so we, you know, we kind of prepared for this and it was just a really fun event. This is why I always think about planning your vacations ahead. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things, because you're not getting lost and looking forward to it, but it keeps you focused on the reasons why you're working out, mm-hmm. why you're eating healthy.
And what you're doing
right?
every day.
You know, and how you're saving up for it, because it was an expensive trip for me at the time, right? And all these different things. So it just, it gives you a goal. Like, visions are different than goal, right? Goal is something that's attainable that you're going to go out there and hopefully achieve, right? So we had this kind of goal, physical, and I like having those in my life. And then a couple of years later, they transformed into Ironmans, actually. I mean, the same actually thing happened. And now that you mentioned that, I was literally with Tim Heil.
Yeah.
And Tim and I were out for a run. He's like, man, have you ever heard of an Ironman? I'm like, I don't even know what it is. Tell me what it is. And I never swam at the time ever in my life. And he was like, yeah, you got to swim. And we were there. Then the next day he's like, hey, just come to the swim practice with me. I was like, dude, I've never swam. Like, I mean, I could swim
doggy paddle.
And I could swim, right? Like, I could swim to the shore if I had it to, or whatever that looked like. And he said, come to it. I never ended up going there, and I never swam before. And I had to borrow goggles, and I was like in board shorts, like, and everyone else is in, like, there's a reason why you wear like tight shorts so you can swim faster, right? And Tim and I were in our own lane, and it was hilarious. Then the next day I signed up for half Ironman. So it's kind of just like, sometimes if we prolong too much, we just don't get anything done. And I think that's one thing about it, kind of as the first lesson of this, is that when something really feels like it's just going to challenge you, and it's going to be something that, you know, you're going to learn a lot from, and you're going to gain a lot from an experience, just sign up for it.
And also how important it is with the people that you surround yourself with.
Yeah, I guess that's a really good point, because both of those came from influence from other people that mm-hmm. were healthy goals mm-hmm. to be able to kind of quench my, I have a very addictive personality, and so I can get involved with things really quickly. And so it kind of directed it to healthy forms, right? Yep. Yeah. So, it's a good point. Who you surround yourself with. And then, because really I learned a lot of, not only lessons from there, but it just, the Ironman itself was a whole other story we'll get into at some point. But when we were climbing again, Kilimanjaro, and also I forgot about this. We did a Vermont hiking trip in the fall. You remember this? They flew up to Vermont and we hired a guide to take us out for 4 days.
Did their kids come?
No, it was just them. And we did a hiking trip and we ended up camping out there to kind of test our gear out.
Oh, yes. I do remember that.
So it was a fun experience in itself. And we were out for 3 or 4 days and we got to experience all, you know. So you don't want to be up in Kilimanjaro kind of figuring out your tent, right?
Yeah, right.
So we did this pre-hike and that was super fun. We did that for 3 or 4 days. So it's just, you have all these different adventures and experience that are in there.
Well, and I'm sorry, another little lesson, but we talk about this often, is about at some point you have to get on a plane to see your friends.
Yeah.
And I feel like that is just that in even the Ironmans, because you've done Ironmans with some of your friends from around, or even those other adventure trips that you used to go on.
Yes.
I think before 24. Maybe you did some afterwards too, but similar concept, right? Like
7 days in the river, flipping a raft and saving a kid's life.
Yes.
Fly
or
fishing.
Some of your hunting trips that you've gone
or
on.
Or snowboarding and heliboarding trips. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You got to get on a plane to see your friends. And we just happen to do that through, you know, extreme sports, but you could get on a friend at a beach. You mm-hmm. can get and see friends and visit Italy, right?
But what is the meaning behind that phrase?
Well, it means that you're essentially most likely you're going to outgrow the conversation and the level of thinking that is around your normal group of people. And just even yesterday, I was on a call with one of my coaching clients and they go, you know, what happens when you outgrow your partner and your friends? And that was a really interesting conversation. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of walked through that, because we hear that a lot with people, not just business partners, but intimate partners. And you know, I'm never here to tell anybody to leave anybody or stay with anybody. That's not my job. My job mm-hmm. is to get you to critically think for things. Well, that's a business partner, intimate partner. And so we just kind of say, okay, well, if you're changing, you know, that's the first step, right? And what happens, here's why it happens. Because when you start to change, what ultimately is the pull of you trying to be somebody different for somebody else, or the old version of you is trying to show up in an old scenario. So for instance, maybe you're making all this change for who you are, and you're doing that at work. Then you go home and you're having to play back into who you used to be.
Right. Or even not in work, but like we've talked about before, like you change as you're doing an Ironman, you change when you're training for a marathon or Kilimanjaro or whatever.
Yeah.
And then you have to go back right into your regular life. And they're like, what's going on?
Yeah. And you see that with friends. So like you're changing at work, maybe even at home, then you go hang out with your friends and your friends haven't changed, but you have.
Yeah.
So then there's this pull that they're trying to get you back down to their level.
Right.
They don't naturally know they're doing that, but you're going, I see the world differently. Mm. And once you see the world differently, you can't go back to that level. There's nothing wrong or right with that. It just means that you've now expanded your viewpoint. So as you see that, the pull
to not want to engage in those conversations grows stronger and stronger each day. That's why you ultimately start drifting away from some of these relationships.
And finding new ones.
And finding new ones because you get around somebody and you go, holy shit, they think like I do.
Yeah. Right? I think that that happens a lot at Project U. And again, getting on a plane to
I'm not alone.
See your friends. Like they all travel from around the country to get together 4 times a year because those relationships and conversations are so powerful.
Yeah. And this is not new. I mean, people have been doing this for years, right? Because they've realized that as you grow, you have to surround yourself by people that are engaged in the same type of conversations you are. Right. And that's different for everybody. It mm-hmm. could be that you really like coding or you really, you know, and that's your thing, or you really like, you know, real estate or hotels or games, right? But every time you grow, there's going to be a pull that if you have to go back to a new way, an older way of thinking that engages in a lower level conversation based on your old you, that's going to feel really inauthentic. There's nothing wrong with the people. No. There's not right or wrong in any of this, by the way. It just is. That's what happens when you start to have to get on a plane, is because the level of conversation that you want to be entertained by, meaning that you're being challenged by, is only going to come from people. The larger your life gets, right, the more you grow, I guess a better way of saying it, the more mm-hmm. you grow personally, consciously, right, spiritually, anyone able to say it, the more that you start to grow there, the harder it is to find people at your level.
Yes. And I was going to just say part for me, some of the distinction is that surrounding being a growth mindset individual and surrounding yourself with that. And oftentimes the people that it's harder to be around are those who have fixed mindsets.
Yeah. And we even see this even in our own world and we take this for granted. I know I take it for granted. Like just being able to have the conversation with you. Like we're in this world and we are all having, because we spend, you know, 90% of our time together just having these conversations. And then you go to another workplace or visit with another group and you're going, wait, what?
Or not necessarily, like I'm sure you have some of these conversations with Sarah, as I do with Bill. And so it's not, that's fine, right? I can have those conversations with them, but then it's like almost outside. Like if I get too many layers outside, even my family, some extended family, it's like, oh, those are a little bit more of that fixed mindset.
Yes. And you recognize it easier.
Yes. Yeah. And great, we'll hang out, but I'm not going to, you know, call them every day. Like I call my sister every day and have those conversations.
Yeah. I think the example I gave last week was, you know, for a while, a couple of my friends from high school, they're actually successful, very successful folks in terms of financial success, bought a second home and they're inviting everybody down, you know, over and over again to, you know, come down and play golf and to hang out and barbecue and all those different things. And it's wonderful, right? It's awesome. I just never went because I don't really like to drink to that level, right? I don't like being out of my routine. Mm-hmm. I love traveling, so it's not that. And I just knew I knew what would happen.
Socializing right?
People. and they're great people too. Yeah. There's different things. That's not my game. And then finally they stopped inviting me. Right. Yeah. I just did. And that's not against me. That's just because I stopped showing up, right?
Right, but
if any one of them wanted to say, hey, do you want to go for a hike? Do you want to go do an Ironman with me? Can I meet with you and talk about business?
Exactly.
Can I talk about spirituality?
You'd be there.
I would be there. And a lot of them listen to this podcast and they love it. But like, I know that for me, I don't want to, it's part of just saying no, mm-hmm. right? And I think people have a tough time with that. Even friends that I know that go down there sometimes to other friends and they're like, I went because I felt like I had to. Yeah. I didn't even like it. I don't like the way I feel. I ended up drinking too much. I ended up not sleeping properly. Now I'm paying for it on Monday. I didn't really have fully engagement on Sunday when I came back because I was trying to recover from just the weekend, just from staying up late, right? Mm-hmm. And doing all these different things. And it's like, they come to me, they're like, how do you say no to all this? That was literally their question. They said, because I would have much rather not gone to that.
Yeah.
And I just said, well, it's pretty easy. I just say no, because I'm very clear on what I want my life to look like.
Well, and you're also okay with other people not liking you for that decision.
That's a good point. Yes. Yeah.
And some people are not okay with that.
Yeah. That's a good point. That's why you're just okay with, if you're going to make that decision, there's always a reaction, right? Mm-hmm. Everything has a reaction to it. So but to me, I'd much rather be in control in what I'm doing and what I'm saying.
And in alignment with what you
exactly.
want.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's get on the plane.
So anyways, we get on the plane, which is, by the way, the first time I actually ever traveled first class in a,
like international,
like where the beds, by the way, that was like amazing. That was like the biggest splurge that I probably had up to that point.
Was it a 2 week or was it a 3 week total?
Two week. And, so that was amazing. We actually, on the way back, I didn't realize what it looked like. And then on the way back, we were like looking forward to it, because you had like your own movie theater in there, and yeah, you could lay down. It was just amazing. And people have had the opportunity to travel internationally on one of those fly down beds. It's pretty amazing. But anyways, so we get over there. I'll tell you the first thing that kind of shocked me was when we got into the village before hiking Tanzania, there was basically one hotel that you know, visitors stayed at. But then I had our guide, he's like, yeah, just stay around the hotel. And I said, no, we want to actually go into the village. He's like, you sure? So the next day, cause we were waiting a day to go up, he brought us into the village, like 30 minutes away from where we were staying in the real village. And we spent like an afternoon there. But one of the first things, I'll never forget this, is walking through there and just seeing two things. One, how much actually joy people had with seemingly nothing. And I mean,
nothing.
No running water, right? I say nothing materially. Yeah, water. They had barely had roofs on their houses. All their floors were dirt, right? People ran around. They had like a little market that they all helped with all each other's goods and community. There were like, it would be like a cubicle desk next to a cubicle and like 3 feet wide, right? And just having all of this. And I remember watching these kids kicking around a soda can that had been wrapped up with duct tape. And then, but it was still like, must have been like a year old, and they were just kicking it and playing it, and they just had shorts on, and they were just so free. They were so excited about us coming in there. They're so inquisitive. And I'm like, man, these kids are so happy. They don't know any different. They have their minimal choices, and they're just enjoying. That hit me hard though, because at the time that was my second child that was born, and I'm going, man, I think I'm spoiling my kids way too much.
I remember when you said that. Yeah,
I'm like, man, I'm spoiling my kids way too much. Like, I'm giving them too many options. Think about when you have too many options, even good options.
Yeah.
Right. Like if you have too many houses, right. I'm not saying you do or I do, but like,
I don't,
but I know people that do. And they're like, you know, it's actually, I have the money to have six houses, but it's actually stressful having them. Right. And so I'm just using that as an example, but you could have, you know, too many clothes. You walk in, I don't know. That's, you know, maybe that's
maybe you have too many.
Yeah. So whatever for some, I have t-shirts.
Too many pairs of Allbirds. Which yes, ones
exactly.
do you wear?
Yes, exactly. And so it's whatever those things are. Right. So I just remember, man, I gotta just limit the choices. And I sat down with my wife at the time and just kind of, we went through that about creating some new values. So that was some new systems. And then sharing that with my kids a lot. And I still share that with my kids about, I want to get them over there once it's time that I can too, to have them go work in one of those villages just to see how people live in a different culture, but also see how happy they are with seemingly nothing that we do. So that was a really cool experience to go through the whole thing and kind of see how they live. And it just a really eye opening, because I'd been to other countries before, but not like that.
Right.
Not like that. And it was fascinating to see. And how resilient people are for what they're living with, right? And so anyways, so then the next day,
and how joy does not come from
it doesn't.
Anything external.
It doesn't. No, it doesn't. So we end up starting the hike, right? So the first day we get up there, and of course, you know, we want to go faster, and the whole time they're like slow, 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 because it's all about, it's not the hike itself, it's acclimation of it. And we get up, you know, I think we ended up doing it in 2.5 days to do the hike up, which is typically a 4 day or 7 day up, so that people can really acclimate and not be, because the thing is it's not as much, if you get altitude sickness, you can't fix it by stopping. You have to come down. So once you get it, you have to come down. And I think at the time, and I could be wrong, because I think like 30% of people do not make it to the top of Kilimanjaro. And it's usually not physical, it's mental.
Yeah.
Because it is, I'm telling you, it's crazy. At the top, the last 5,000 feet, it's really hard to breathe. We'll get to that, but anyways.
Do they bring oxygen?
Some people do. Yeah, some people do. Yeah. Majority of people do not need oxygen at that level.
And why did it only take you 2.5 days versus that? Did you guys just choose to
go?
We
choose to go faster because we were
advanced group kind of thing.
Yeah, 30-year-old kids thinking that we're. And actually, when I bought like insurance for the trip, but one of the things they said is like, don't be a hero out there. We come in because we had like Global Rescue at the time, so like if you need to be picked up, and they said we pick so many people up outside of Tanzania. Because it's not the older people, it's you guys who try to run up this mountain and become sick and have to be pulled out of there.
Oh, gosh.
And so I remember him saying that. So we kind of heeded to that messaging a little bit. Anyways, so we ended up making the first day hike. It was awesome. You know, we had paid to have somebody that carried like a... like our bags. So we just had a day pack that we had to carry. So we were only carrying the whole thing, which was nice. So we get up there and, you know, we set up the first tent and it's just beautiful. It's awesome. Making friends and just learning people from there. And then the second day we get up to I think it must have been 3 days. So the second day we get up to about 10 or 11,000 feet. And we went up, I think, to 12,000. Then you come back down to sleep at 9,000 as you go up and come back down. It helps acclimate those things. But at that time, one of our friends that were on there started to have oxygen deprivation. So they measured your oxygen every night. And typically, like, your oxygen level should run around really like 99%, but really like 96% or above, right? And his was down like 90%. So it's kind of like a, like, we should pay attention to this, right?
Yeah.
And then the next day, it's a long trek. So you start early and you go down and then come up and you're working your way all around this. And there's some pretty steep sections there. And you basically get to almost 15,000 feet. And right about 15,000 feet, and this is, I mean, I'm shortening the story, but basically there's a lot of time in there. It's hot, it's cold. You know, you're starting to feel altitude a little bit. Like, you can feel really dry. But up until about 10,000, you're pretty good. And then I could start getting headache a little bit, you know, those different things. I didn't take any medicine. I had some, but I didn't take any at all because they said, if you take it when it's time, it doesn't work. And I just didn't want to take it because I wanted to see if I could do it without the medicine. Surprisingly. So we ended up, I think the second day we kind of were hanging around 10,000. Again, it's beautiful. We had awesome weather. You know, it's obviously at night it gets really cold. And then once you get up to 15,000 feet, this is where things started getting really tricky. This, by the way, is where crowds started to separate. So the base camp at number two was full. Base camp at number three, it's called base camp number three, and it was our third night there. What was a quarter of what it was in base camp two.
Is that because people had stopped?
People went up and then came back down, went up, came back down. So they were really acclimating before they went all the way up there.
Okay, that's just why it takes that 7 days.
Why it takes the 7 days. Because again, it's not that hard to get up there. It's just they go up, acclimate, up, and they keep going back down to a level where they can start really acclimating. It's really the best, smarter way to do it, right?
Got it.
But of course, we went up there the next day, and there was, at this base camp, people don't hang out up there too. So we went up there, and again, there's a quarter, but once you get up there, it's like a 10-hour trek to get up there. Well, at least it was for us that day.
You mean to the summit?
To base camp three.
Oh, okay.
And so basically at that level, at least what we were calling base camp three, and that's at 15,000 feet. So you're above the clouds at this point. It's just remarkable, but it's nobody's talking. No, seriously, like, it starts, like, people stop talking. It's hard to talk.
Conserving energy.
It's hard to breathe. Mm. And what's really interesting about altitude, people don't necessarily always realize this, at least I didn't, it's not necessarily a lack of oxygen. It's the barometric pressure that drops that puts oxygen into your body. So when the barometric pressure is like 30, there's enough pressure for you to be able to bring in oxygen into your lungs. As it gets below, I think when we were getting to the top, it was like 17 or 18 in the barometric pressure, which means that there's not the pressure to keep the oxygen contained for you to be able to get it in a small breath. So essentially, I'm not, you know, a scientist here, but that's essentially what happens.
Okay.
That's why when you're at altitude, you have to, you're trying to breathe in, you're trying to create pressure to get oxygen into your body. And that's why it takes a lot to breathe in at the higher altitudes. It's not that there's really a lack of oxygen. I guess you could say there is. It's just not condensed from the pressure so that when you take a normal breath here, mm-hmm. you can get a lot into it, right? So then you're already taking these deep breaths, which it feels kind of interesting. But this is where things started getting really interesting. So we went up there and they set up a little tent for us to sit in. But it's cold up there, right? I mean, it's freezing.
What time did you get? I know you left base camp at 11.
I think that day we left at like, call it maybe like 7 in the morning. And we got to the third base camp at call like 6 o'clock at night.
And you were going
to
hang there for a little bit until 11.
Yeah, so basically you come in there and you're supposed to sleep for a couple hours or relax. Nobody slept. And then you summit.
Right.
So basically we got up there and we started sitting at a table eating, and nobody's really saying anything. We're kind of joking around a little bit. And then one of our guys, Aaron, was like, hey, you know, he hadn't said anything for a little while, and we're kind of watching him, but we were kind of laughing a little bit.
Yeah.
And he was like, I think I'm going to go to bed. We're like, okay, great. And our tents up there, there's not much real estate, right? Our tents were like 3 feet apart, right? And so the tent that we were eating in was probably literally, no joke, 4 feet from the entrance of our eating tent, which was only like 10 feet wide, right? So it's not like, it's like this big canopy here. So you're in this little room with a little table in there. And so he gets out and starts, we can see his silhouette walking around our tent like 2 or 3 times. And we're like, man, what's he doing? We kind of didn't think anything of it. Then we didn't see it. And then all of a sudden, like 10 minutes later, it comes back and we see the silhouette around the tent again. And then all of a sudden we're like, dude, who's that? Because we hadn't seen anybody. And he opens the door, it's Aaron. He's like, guys, it's crazy. I can't find my tent. And that's right then when Nick looked at me and he's like, That's a problem. Like his tent, we were like, we walked outside, we showed him and go, dude, your tent is right there. Mm-mm. And it's open. It's got his stuff in it. I mean, it's 3 feet from the entrance of where it was. That's when we went and got our guide and was like, hey, dude, like, and then he put his oxygen level on. It was like an 81% oxygen. Yeah. And anything below 80%, at least our guides were like, you can't go up. We'll take you down.
And does it just cause disorientation or?
Yeah, confused. You're just not getting oxygen to your brain.
Right, right.
There's not enough oxygen in your body and it can cause major problems. And that's at 15,000 feet. And the guy's like, we have to take him down. And of course, he started getting loose. He's like, no, I'm going, like going. And he's like, okay, but if it gets below this, we're going to turn around at any point in time. So we went and laid down. And I was actually starting to get concerned for him because, I mean, that's pretty interesting. And your mind starts doing crazy things. Like, I really, at that point, started going like, am I going to make it? Because I'm sitting there, laying there in my bed, just not sleeping, but just laying there resting, going, it's hard for me to breathe right now. I'm like, dude, am I going to make this? Like, I remember people saying like marathon runners can't make it up there. It's not to do with your physicality. It's to do with your oxygen ability to process, intake. You know, altitude. Every body is a little bit different. And I'm like, man, maybe I'm not going to make it. So I just started, like, my mind started going down that path. For one, I'm tired, haven't eaten right. You're exhausted. You're already losing oxygen. So you can see how your mind starts playing with you, right? And so it's from there. And so you had to win over that mind, right? Something that we've always continue to talk about, that voice inside your head. I didn't say at the time about your voice inside your head. I wish I had that knowledge then. But anyways, it's just that voice inside your head talking a lot. So we get up and they wake us up and they say, let's go.
How did you, I mean, even if you didn't have the language then, like, how did you talk yourself through? I mean, I know you weren't going to go down, but is that just because you were like, I am not going down?
Yeah. And this is, you know, it's really interesting. I was going to say this in a little bit, but since you asked it, I see, this is the first time I can understand why people die on Everest. Because when you're climbing, you are so motivated and so inspired and you're there, getting there, and you have this adrenaline driving you. Because people don't die going up on Everest. They die coming down. 99% of deaths on Everest happen on the way down.
Because they waited too long to go up. Like, I don't know. What does that mean exactly?
Well, because you have all, I'll tell you, like, people know that I summited. So basically, once you get to the summit, it was the hardest thing about the entire trip was once I got there, I lost my adrenaline.
Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah.
And there was no more, like, you reach the summit, you're there, we cried.
Yeah, it's like, right? There's not the motivation anymore.
And all of a sudden, you're like, literally in that moment, I turn around and I'm like, holy shit, we have to go down.
Yeah. Okay.
And I'm so tired. And you're just growing on nothing but energy to get to the top. So let me just preface that.
Got it.
But anyways, we're going up and nobody's saying a word in our group. Nobody's talking. It's like I'm seeing stars the whole way. And my mind starts getting really like, wow, are we going to make this? You're going to make this. And I'm just there. And we do a stop. And all of a sudden I look at Aaron and he's kind of like wobbling. And our guide comes over out of nowhere and just slaps Aaron across the face as hard as he can. And Aaron's like, whoa, I needed that. Like, but like, you could tell he was not with it because it normally, like, and their guide was trying to see how he responded to the slap, not like he wanted to slap him. Like he was actually seeing like, did he even feel this?
Right. Or did his head just like roll?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And he did. And he sat down for a little while and kind of came back up. And anyways, he's like, we should turn him around. And at that point that was the first time I said, you need to go down. Because I saw what happened when he just smacked him on the side of the face. And I remember going, he's like, no, I'm not going. And I'm like, dude, you need to go down. Like, he's like, no, I'm right here. That's why when I say, like, I see how people die on Everest.
Yeah,
because in that, there's, and this is Kilimanjaro. I mean, people in Everest pay $75,000. They wait 10 days. They get an opening to go up to the summit. Yeah. They're there at the summit.
They can train it.
Yeah. I totally understand that now.
But I know it was about 5,000 feet between the two, but like, how long does that take?
We started at 11. We summited at 6 a.m.
Okay. So it's quite a,
it's 9 hours or so. Yeah. So basically what we started doing is we started hiking up and that was about halfway point. So we were like 17,000 feet at that point. Yes. When he got slapped just cause it was there and he rallied, he drank some water, did those things and started getting up there. And, it's hard walking. It's freezing at this point. It's still in the middle of the night. I mean, it gets below, you know, negative, it gets negative 50 up there with the wind chill and stuff. So it's, I mean, you're talking serious cold, right? So anyways, we get to about a little halfway, maybe like 18,000 feet or so. And he's like, hey, remember in a little while, there's going to be this false summit. And they told you about this false summit for a while. And you know about it intellectually, right? You know that there's a false summit. By the way, this is also a great business parallel because I can also see why people's businesses go failure because they don't know when to turn around.
Mm.
They don't know when to stop. They don't know when to sell. They don't need to win to change direction.
Yep.
It's because they're so vested into the idea about doing it that they can't see their own blind spots.
Yeah, for sure.
And so I remember teaching that a lot when thinking about that and that parallels when I came back of being like, I can see why people die on Everest and I can see why people go bankrupt without changing their model. Blockbuster, right? Because they're, mm-hmm. whatever it is, like you're so tied to something or all the companies that never, you never heard of because they weren't able to iterate. I mean, Amazon started off selling books. Right. I mean, what is that? Make up now like 0.0001% of what they do because they iterated, right?
Yeah.
And so it's just a great example of where are your blind spots that you're not seeing it. Sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't. Anyway, so we get up there and we're hiking. We knew this false summit. And so I saw the summit and I knew it was intellectually a false summit, but you're kind of out of it. And I remember just getting there thinking, even knowing that it wasn't there, but thinking that it was somehow like they were playing a trick on me. Like that's what my mind was doing. It was like, they're lying to me. They're just doing this. Like, I'm serious. Like all this stuff's going through your mind. And I get there and I look over left and they're not lying.
Oh God.
And it's like 700 yards up there, but it's like, I tell you, it's like ram ventilation. You're going like deep yoga breaths, every breath. And so you can't move fast. That's why when you see people on Everest, like, it's only 100 yards, just run up there and touch it, right? Like Rocky. You can't physically move because there's just a lack of oxygen. It's hard to breathe. It'd be like, I always tell people, like, trying to walk at your heaviest run that you've ever done. That's what it feels like walking from trying to breathe.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you just, that's because you can't get oxygen in. And so you're hiking up and you're doing these different things. And so from that summit on, by the way, that last bit, we walked for maybe, I don't know, 15 minutes. And basically, Aaron collapsed. And his oxygen level was super low, but he was still close. So Nick and I ended up putting Aaron over our shoulders and carried him the rest of the way.
And
so
how long? Like in the hour?
An hour,
like
probably. Yeah, maybe an hour. It could have been a little bit, maybe a half hour at this point. But like we ended up carrying him the rest of the way. And we got up there. And right when he got there, like we all cried because like we were, I was actually, you know, one of the reasons I cried because I saw, for one, I was proud of other people.
Yeah.
I knew I was, for some reason, I just kind of knew like I would do it.
Right.
And maybe I was proud for me, but I was mostly proud for like Aaron because how I saw how difficult it was over the last couple of days and how it was and how much he struggled, but just didn't stop. And so we all just shared that moment and took some pictures and I turn around to go take another picture and maybe look at something. And all of a sudden I look over and one of the porters has Aaron on his shoulders running down the mountain, running down the mountain there. Cause then I turn around and I go, well, he's going to like, we need to get him down immediately.
Yeah.
And so they just took off. We stayed up there for a few minutes. We saw the sunrise came up, but that's when I said, like, that's when the biggest letdown came after about a half an hour of being up there, max. It was like, oh my God, I have to go down.
Yeah.
And it was like, that was the worst part of the entire trip. It was turning around going like, oh, and then it was like an 8-hour venture because you're going past the first base camp 3. So you're going all the way down to like 11,000 feet that day because they're trying to get you back down to a level that's reasonable. So we had, it was like a, you climb for like 7 or 8 hours and then it was an 8-hour back down. And that's so, long. And in the first like 3,000, you're still breathing really hard. And then it starts getting easier and easier and easier. And finally you're just so tired. I remember this is where you had to push so hard in your mind. Like I remember both of us, we were just walking down this trail. I'm so tired and I'm so exhausted. I'm so thirsty and all this stuff. And I saw our tent there and I literally walked into camp, just like you see in a movie. And I just, with my backpack and everything, I turned in and I just fell into my camp and I just laid there. I did. I just sat and Nick did the same thing because Nick and I were sharing a room because Aaron needed his own. And we just laid there with our backpacks on and everything. And it was just, and then we rested, we ate, and then we started getting some energy back up. And I may have took a nap because I think we got down there. We ended up getting there like noon or whatever it was or one. And so we took a little nap and then we ate dinner. And then it started being fun again. We came back down. So that was like, and then from there you get out the next day, right? So you go down there and then obviously taking a shower felt amazing once you actually got down there. But it was funny. We're all sitting around the hotel and it was kind of interesting thing after, and the group had just summited too. That was there, not with us, but it was come down there. Cause again, there was like one hotel for visitors and they're like, we're all sitting around like having a glass of wine or something. And they were like, hey, did you guys see that old man getting carried off the mountain? And we laugh about it now. And Aaron's there and he's like, yeah, that was me. And they were like, oh my God, we're so sorry. Like it was, and he was like, no, I did it. And he was all better at this point too. Right. And get the whole thing. So, you know, it was a really, so you asked the question about how did you get through with the mind without kind of knowing the voice. And what I had is I had a little mantra. right? There's two things that I really, that played out that I didn't mention. Number one is I had a mantra that I just kept reciting over and over and over again. And I forget exactly what it was.
I know you shared it at some point.
I did. It was, I don't know. We'll have to maybe put in the show notes, but it was like two or three sentences. And I just kept reiterating it over and over again. Like basically like my subconscious is strong enough to be able to put me through this different thing. I know it's something along those lines. Yep. And like, I know I can get through it. Just kept reiterating over and over and over again. And just helped me not go to the pain. It helped me not go to the mind of just derailing me. So it's just something we can do. We can use 3, 2, 1, relax now. There's a whole bunch of mantras, and it's much more common to talk about mantras anyways. The other thing is about halfway up, right before we stopped, I started laughing, hiking up, and when nobody said anything. So like an hour later when we stopped, people were like, why are you keep laughing? And I said, well, the reason why I was doing that is because I love the Navy SEALs. And one of the things that the Navy SEALs do when things they're doing Hell Week is when it gets really, really tough, they laugh as a group. And the laughing helps you prevent you from feeling the pain and or just really focusing on the pain. Mm-hmm. So when it got real like dark, I mean real dark in your eyes, cause the oxygen and things like that, I would just laugh.
Because it just shifts your
focus, and I would just start laughing.
Or even I feel like to a certain degree, it's almost like you can't be angry and get gratitude at the same time. Can you, if you're laughing, do you feel the pain? I don't know.
So the same thing goes like in business or in life, when life's giving you cards that you don't like, you have the opportunity to be angry at the cards or play them and laugh. Right. So it's like all those, that was a wonderful lesson in my life for like when things get really challenging, which it will almost every day. Can you laugh at it? Can you laugh at you? Your business is facing reputational challenges. Can you laugh at it and make a change? You're facing a lawsuit. Can you laugh at it and fix it? It doesn't mean you take an activity, right? It's not passivity.
And it also doesn't mean that you're not facing reality.
No, you're actually, the laughing actually allows you to face reality.
Yeah, what I was trying to say before is it changes your state.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Back to like a more neutral state so you can actually solve the problem.
Right.
Right, and look at it clearly. So that was a great lesson to be able to teach it. Then the kind of last thing I'll share is we went to the Serengeti. It was called Singida. It was the largest private game reserve in the entire Serengeti. And the guy that actually ended up, we had learned in history, it's 300,000 acres. And the guy used to be a big hunter there. And then he was a billionaire on Wall Street. And then he had a whole change. He didn't want to hunt anymore. And so what he ended up doing is he leased the land. But in order the way he did it is he has to buy the hunting licenses every year for that area to be able to prevent people from doing it. So that's how his fees go.
Yep.
Anyways, we're there. And the thing, I did see a cheetah stalk because it was a private thing so we could drive anywhere around there. I saw a cheetah actually hunt a gazelle for like 6 hours. I'll tell you, 5 out of the 6 hours, 5 hours and 50 minutes was boring as heck. I mean, seriously, it was the patience of this cheetah. Yeah. It would stay low, creep, and you could barely see it, and it would creep, and then it would chase and miss one. And then finally, one just happened to like walk by. I mean, I was like, dude, because we could see it. We're like, he's gonna get it. Because the gazelle kept walking right towards him, just didn't know.
Yeah.
And then you could see the cheetah, and then it just pounded it within like 5 seconds, it grabbed it. And we drove up, you can see the pictures, we drove up to like 7 feet from the cheetah, blood all over his mouth. Because cheetahs, they spend so much energy when they kill, they actually don't eat right away. Mm. They stop and pause and they try to, like a leopard will drag it up in a tree.
Right.
A cheetah will try to drag it to a shaded area to preserve it because they're so burnt out from the hunts.
I can't even enjoy it.
So it's like the recovery time, right? Yeah. Like we all have to have recovery time. Then we just, so that was a really interesting thing to watch that whole thing unfold, but just watch how like nature recovers. And the interesting thing is they would eat it. They also knew that there was a lot of predators like hyenas that would overcome them, or lion, like a pack of lions. A cheetah can't do anything to that. So they had to protect their kill. Mm. So they would try to eat as much as they can and relax, only knowing they had a very limited time.
Right.
That cheetah had less than an hour and a pack of hyenas were on there. They just moved them away. So they spent all this different time doing this. And that's why hyenas travel in packs, because they need to have the pressure to be able to push the animal off it. So they, because they don't really kill anything by themselves. They always take things that something else has already killed.
Scavengers. Yeah.
But it was just also, then you can also start to see how everything's interconnected. Then a guy was showing us, like how all like the birds, these birds eat certain nuts, but they don't eat the outside shells. They only eat inside, but they crack them all and they fall on the ground. And then this bird eats that. And then it drops over here. And then this squirrel eats. He was showing us how everything, was the first time in my life that I saw how in nature, how everything was so, and maybe I hadn't been on a device for 14 days, right? Like just how interconnected everything was. And there was a reason for everything.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason why animals hunt. And then, and other animals are hunting packs. And then some birds don't eat the outside shells, but some do, because each one has a process to play.
Right. I was gonna say purpose.
Yeah, they do. And it all supports life. It's like life knew what it was doing or something.
Yeah.
And so it was, it also kind of started my inward journey of realizing that, hey, life knows what it's doing. It's giving you cards every day. It doesn't care if you like the cards from your mind, but it knows what it's doing. It pretty, for the most part, it knows how to supply rain and knows how to, you know, deforest things from natural fires to regrow things, not necessarily to our advantage as we see it, but as nature as a whole for 4.8 billion years, it's done a pretty good job of raining. A pretty good job of providing things. Yes, there are some times it misses it, right? But nature supports everything. It supports you. It gives you everything you need.
Right, and I was just going to say, like, in the missing it, I'm thinking of, like, the Dust Bowl or, you know, yeah. whatever, where there was no rain. But maybe that in and of itself served some purpose.
Purpose that we can't see.
Right.
It's only until you can get the broader context. Like, the bird doesn't know it's dropping for something else. It just knows it's going after that. The apple tree doesn't know it's producing apples for something else to have, right? Then we hoard everything, right? Just do yeah. it. So Western rules. But it was really interesting to see how everything was so interconnected. The paths that, you know, the wildebeest and the great migration create and what that turns up to allow another animal to come through and get certain nutrients from the path that it comes. Everything has this interconnected play to it.
Well, while you were there, were you singing Lion King songs in your head
maybe
the whole time?
Maybe a little bit. one of the coolest moments of my life was when we were just laying out and Singida is a pretty luxury resort, but it's like a luxury tented resort. So everything's outside.
Oh, you were glamping.
We're glamping big time. And these outdoor showers glamping. Right. And you know, we weren't allowed to walk at night in case a tiger there, but we would be sleeping and you could hear tigers walk by and lions roaring, walking by your tent.
I don't think there are tigers.
Yeah, a ton of tigers. And they're lions.
Lions.
But one of the cool things was one day after a morning, kind of going looking around for things, you had like a time just relax. And so they had these like a twin bed set up, like that's what they had. They were like not twin beds, but they were the size of a twin bed, under like 100 yards away from the cabins or their little tents underneath these big shaded trees. And you could just sit there and watch the entire Serengeti from like this viewpoint. And I remember just for like every day, as soon as we get out, I'd just go there and I'd just sit there and watch by myself. Cause you know, I'm introverted and I had to be around a lot of people. And I would just sit there and watch, and it was so perfect out. Like the breeze, like there'd be a giraffe and then you'd see a lion run by and they just started becoming ordinary. But it was just like this amazing, just watching how everything unfolds. And then also watching the fact that there was predators and prey interacting with each other within 30 yards. But yet there was never like, it would be like there'd be a lion and a giraffe there, but sometimes they attack giraffes, sometimes they don't. Or there'd be like hyenas and lions just kind of laying down when they weren't hungry. It was almost like nature, yes, they attack each other sometimes, but a lot of times they don't. It's like they interact with each other.
Mm-hmm.
It was just really cool to watch all of that unfold. And you know, just like sometimes humans don't fight each other, sometimes they do. It's like there's like this you know, push and pull, but there's also like this camaraderie of interconnectedness of everything. And that was just that kind of cemented it in there. And I always kind of go back to just laying there of what that was like in that moment. I actually want to go back there at some point and experience it with my family when they're old enough to actually experience it, because there's a lot. There's a lot of animals going around. Right?
I was gonna say, would you do just the Serengeti thing?
Yeah, I mean, I would climb it if they wanted to, but we'd have to see. But yeah, that was just the whole interconnectedness. So whenever you know, spirituality, business meets spirituality, you know, in the easiest of definitions, it just means that spirituality just means there's something larger than you. And I think of anything from this story, and what I really want to convey in this 100th episode, is that we are all so interconnected. Every one of us. We are interconnected. We understand life supports life. It supports us even when it doesn't happen. And life is truly unfolding for you. It's not happening to you. It's happening for you. We just have to get out of our own way. And that was just a wonderful lesson that we can all take away, is when life gets really tough, to pause, experience what you're experiencing, but ask yourself the question of, what is life trying to teach me here? Because there is no accidents or no mistakes if it's happened, because by definition, it should have.